Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 19. I'm Michael Shoebridge, and I'm here with the head of research at SAA, Dr. Marcus Hellyer. Well, I'm not actually here with Marcus. We're recording this virtually.
Yeah, neither of us are here, actually. I'm in Adelaide. I'm at the ASC shipyard. I'm trying to bring industrial harmony to the waterfront. Some of you may have heard that the workforce at ASC has gone on strike because they want equal pay with their colleagues based in Perth. And speaking of Perth, that's where Michael is.
Well, I'm actually at the Henderson precinct, Marcus. You probably can't see that in the background here, but it's all being blown up and reconfigured to be a new intergalactic hub for shipbuilding.
A lot of shipbuilding.
Probably bigger, I think, than Osborne in intergalactic capacity terms. But I'm here hoping that you have success in that wages claim for the workers in Osborne.
I think we'll get a good outcome.
Because as soon as you do, the workers here at Henderson are going to go on strike to maintain our margins that are higher than yours.
Well, that sounds reasonable.
And if I succeed, I think you could do the same.
Well, then I think I'll have to work with the Adelaide workforce to get parity again.
Well, that's why these smart jobs are so important to the Australian community. But one thing that I do feel a bit crestfallen by is you and I did some great feng shui work down at Adelaide, and that was meant to create a whole lot of positive energy. It looks like whatever we did, however good it was, it didn't create the harmony that the country
needs. There is some bad energy at ASC at Osborne at the moment, but I think we can fix it.
Some of this bad energy could be resolved by a bit of clarity about what's happening with one of the big things they work on, the Collins submarine. Collins, the life of type extension, it's so hot right now. We talked last episode about the crewing crisis that's already coming to the submarine workforce as Defence tries to simultaneously grow crews for the Virginia-class submarines and maintain crews for the Collins. But keeping the submarines, Collins submarines, viable, but only for long enough, I think it's the really interesting balance Defence has to strike.
Yes, well, I think where we got to last episode, so with the, you know, revelation out of the US that not only will we need 3,000 submariners for the SSN force, but we're probably, to get there, going to have to start cannibalizing the Collins workforce starting right now. Means, you know, the thing we said, Collins ain't going to make it out of the 2030s. So what does that mean for the life of type extension? If we sort of go back a few years in the attack class program, we got to the point where, because of the gap, the capability gap, Defence said, right, we're going to have to put all six Collins through a life of type extension.
Just because it was going to take so long for new French attack class submarines to be built.
Yeah, plus we wanted to increase the overall number of submarines. And so those two drivers combined meant that Defence was going to put all six boats through a life of type extension.
Because it wasn't doing a one-for-one retirement, was it? It was trying to keep some of the Collins to build the total number.
Theoretically, yes, that could have been part of it.
Yeah.
So, but if you do the maths and you go, all right, the first life of type extension starts in 26, that boat comes out in 28, the last of the six boats would go in 36, come out in 38. The life of type extension gives it 10 years more life. So theoretically, the last Collins could be serving until 2048.
Well, in fact, if you scope the life of type extension for the Collins to be all six boats, that's really what you get, isn't it? If it all works, of course, you get a Collins submarine that's still operational in 2048, which is still before the last of the AUKUS submarines turns up. But that's a long time from now.
That's a long time from now. And plus, as we determined last week, you're not going to have any Collins workforce left. Well before then, we're going to be out of Collins submariners. So that raises the question, well, what is the LOT now? It's now something different.
This is that quote, isn't it? But you've changed your mind. Well, when the facts change, I change my mind. The LOT is a project that was designed when we had a very different plan and very different assumptions. As you say, it was designed at the time that the French were building the world's quietest submarine you'll never see.
And we never saw it.
The Australian Navy is never going to see
it. So the Dutch might see it.
Yeah, so basic planning assumption now has to be, what's the timeline for the AUKUS submarine? And what's it doing to crewing and also workforce numbers to maintain submarines?
Right, so we're going to start cannibalizing Collins' workforce pretty soon. The other thing is what is driving the transition to the SSN force? And Admiral Meade has said a number of times, what he is trying to do is essentially to go nuclear as fast as possible. So no longer is the absolute number of boats the main goal. We're not necessarily trying to increase the number of boats. We're actually trying to go nuclear as soon as possible. So if Collins actually gets in the way of that by drawing a big competition for workforce, for industrial resources, you're going to get rid of Collins. So
if it's a choice between I need to make the nuclear submarines and their supporting infrastructure work, or I need to keep Collins for a bit longer, you're going to choose the future.
You're going to choose the future. So particularly when, you know, by my count, we have 10 major pieces of industrial activity to do in that transition, including Collins upgrades, bringing online Virginia upgrades, starting construction of SSN AUKUS,
the East Coast base,
submarine rotation, all of those things, something's going to fall off the bottom and it's going to be your lowest priority, which is Collins. So the low looks very different. And actually, if you look at the current timelines for Collins, even without the low, the last boat, it's about to start its full cycle docking, will come out in 26. That will serve until 2036. Ooh. So in a sense, if you could take a very minimalist view and go, we're not actually going to do a load at all. We're just going to do a bit of spit and polish here, replace a few of the broken elastic bands. A sort of minimal load might be one approach.
It's getting pretty close to the end of the 2030s, isn't it? Depending on how you cosset those last Collins submarines. So without going to the expense, risk and time of doing the load, if you just said, you know, my plan is to keep enough Collins running to keep crew busily at work and keep an at-sea submarine available until I've got three Virginias, you would save multiple billions of dollars and you'd take some of the strain off all the high risk things you need to do to get the AUKUS submarine.
Yeah, I mean, I think it fundamentally changes the option space. So, and the other thing to remember is we've got Submarine Rotation Force West coming under the optimal pathway where we'll have US boats, and I don't quite believe it, but part of the plan is to have a British boat in the West. So you've sort of got your get out of jail card there of a fleet of Allied boats based in the West.
Don't you think that UK submarine, nuclear submarines are already very hard to spot except when they're in port, but I think it'll be like an extremely rare bird sight to see an astute class submarine docking at Stirling. It'll be one of those things where you'll have submarine watchers from around the world turning up to see this unheard of event every now and then. It'll be like Lake Eyre filling up and all those fabulous birds turning up there.
Yes, I think it will be a rare sighting to have an astute out here. But putting that aside, Submarine Rotation Force West is that kind of fallback, that safety net. So I think it fundamentally changes what you do in the load. So the sort of big load that we got to of replacing the main motors, the diesel generators, the electrical distribution systems,
periscope
with optronics, why would you A, do the cost of all of that? Why would you have the risk that you start doing this huge upgrade and it blows out from 2 years to 3 years to more? So if you're essentially not trying to get this thing out to the 2048, but it's just kind of getting to the mid-30s, maybe you don't do a bunch of capability upgrades.
Well, and maybe you don't start with the oldest boats.
Correct.
If you put some of the younger boats, you put the midlife boats in. So you don't put the one that's coming out of the full cycle docking in, because that one's got life into the late 2030s anyway. You put the ones where, well, if the AUKUS schedule slips, I might still need a couple of Collins. You put those in. You probably end up, I think we've talked about doing an ANZAC, where you say, gosh, I just opened up Collins. I was really keen to do the full life of type extension, but I just looked at the condition and it's just, you know, that propulsion shaft is wobbly. The hydraulics are, I think we need to retire this one.
Yeah, well, I agree. So what you might do is, so the currently, the it's the oldest boats that are meant to go into the load first.
Why?
You may just retire them. You say, I've lost the workforce, so I'll retire the oldest boats and I'll just, the younger boats, I'll give them a bit of work, you know, a bit of assurance work, keep them running. I'll make sure I'm confident they can keep running until the mid-2030s.
Make sure those anchoic tiles are stuck on with the best glue.
Yep. Yeah. And it's a very different proposition and then you can actually redesign your workforce and say, I only want to keep three or four Collins going and I'll build my workforce model around that.
You know what bothers me though, it's I'm reminded of that announcement around the large optionally crewed vessel. At the time,
the optionally crewed vessels that we will crew.
Yeah, so the option is there to have an uncrewed vessel And when the Navy's in a workforce crisis, you think they'd grab that, well, with both hands if they could find the hands to grab it. But you'd think you'd take the option to have less people involved in your system. But I think it must have been the Navy that proposed to Minister Miles that when he made that announcement, he assured the Australian public the optionally crewed vessels would be crewed. So I would have hoped that Minister Miles would be saying, I want you to look at this Loke plan and I want a plan that better manages the dual submarine fleet, the Collins and the Virginias, to go nuclear early. And if that means reducing the Collins a bit faster and not doing all of them, I'm open-minded. But I think he's already come out publicly saying we need to do all six.
Well, he said recently that we were committed to doing the Loke. Are we doing all six? But here's the problem, Michael. You know, ever since the Loke has been around, and it's been around as a concept for a decade now, may not have had the name, but we've known for over a decade we'd have to do something to bridge the gap between the Collins and the future submarine force. And so the Collins was always our kind of strategic risk mitigator for schedule and capability risk in this transition. So the problem with saying, well, we're just going to descope the load, we won't do a lot of work, we won't do all boats. The problem is, what happens if we get to, say, 2030 and we go, oops, we're trying to stand up the SSN capability, but gosh, doing those facilities is hard. Establishing that regulatory framework is hard. Establishing those safety system is hard. All that stuff is kind of hard. The US, oops, they're a little short on boats. So getting the first SSN by 2032, that may slide a few years. And then the second boat, that may slide a few more years, and the boat after that may slide a few years. So you may, if you don't do anything in the load and it gets to 2030, 2032, and SSNs are not coming online, well, you got nothing.
You know, my answer to that is, well, in life you've got to make some choices and you've got to choose the priority thing to spend your time on. If the AUKUS submarine schedule is so wobbly that you're so unsure you're going to get these things on any schedule that remotely resembles, you know, the first one turning up in 2032, another one slightly later in the 2030s, another one before the end of the 2030s, and then the first AUKUS boat turning up in 2042. If that schedule is so risky that you really need to spend billions of dollars to keep Collins in case the whole thing slips, I think you've got a bigger problem. That's one thing. So if the Loke stays total in its scope, which is scooping out everything inside the boats and sticking a whole new submarine inside the old shell, and all six of them are committed to, that to me is an alarm bell about the level of risk in the actual nuclear submarine part.
Well, I think that gets to a sort of another philosophical point here, and that is the Collins is sort of envisaged as the strategic risk mitigator for that transition, but it can't be because it's actually part and parcel of that transition. It is baked into that transition, so it actually itself brings a whole bunch of risk to that transition. So to me, if you want a strategic risk mitigator for the submarine transition, it actually has to be outside of the submarine capability. And whether we're talking the old favour of B-21s or whether we're talking the smaller smart and the many, or whatever it is, it actually has to be outside of the submarine space.
It's not a crewed submarine.
Tell you already, the surface fleet is not going to be that risk mitigator because it itself has warts all over it. So I think all we can say is whatever form the load takes, that is not your risk mitigator in this space. You need things outside of the submarine space, and I would say outside of the maritime space.
Yeah. Amongst all these uncertainties, there are two things I'm pretty certain about. The first one is all six Collins will not end up going through an extremely extended life of type extension program.
I would bet everything on that.
And the second thing is a Collins submarine will not be serving in the Royal Australian Navy in 2040.
I would bet almost. I'd say I'm about 98% sure of that.
And to get 2% more sure for billions of dollars and the opportunity cost of sucking those talented Australians into the Collins system, I don't think it's worth it.
Yeah.
But the other big question is, let's say two Collins submarines are retired earlier than planned. What happens with them? I think this gets us into another planning assumption that defence doesn't want to change. They have what's called a disposals branch. It might even be a division now because nothing serious can be done without having
I was once offered a job running that branch. I think it was a metaphor for my defence career, but anyway.
So disposal. So defence's way of thinking is in the name. When they retire something, they want to dispose of it. And what they've done in the past...
Well, you know, as senior defence official recently said, we don't mothball stuff in the ADF, which is interesting because pretty much everybody else does, because you never know when you're going to need it. You never know when you might need some capability for a rainy day. And as we've seen in the war in Ukraine, people are pulling stuff out of everywhere to try and support the Ukrainians.
Well, I heard the UK former defence minister talking recently, and he said the UK can't produce enough 155mm artillery rounds to give to the Ukrainians. They've depleted all their stockpiles because they've held very few themselves. So they've been scouring the world for anyone anywhere that's got some old 155mm rounds in the shed. So this happens. And you look at that thing about we don't mothball stuff. I think it was the Chief of Navy, the Australian Chief of Navy, that said that. Well, I think the Russians are pretty glad they've put stuff in all kinds of boneyards, sheds and fields. And Qantas seems to believe you can store stuff and get it back into service. They've been doing that with their giant A380s. During COVID, they whacked them in the desert in America, and they've been bringing them back into service.
Not only did we not mothball our MRH-90 helicopters, we didn't even offer them to the Ukrainians. What we have done is strip them, and apparently we're going to chainsaw them and bury them in a hole.
So the current approach defence has to disposals, to when it retires stuff, is to think of disposing. So I think the word itself needs to change. Instead needs to be a strategic reserve and stockpiling mentality, or a do I have a friend in need, could still get some use out of this old set of running shoes I'm getting rid of. So instead of selling, sinking, or cutting up and burying stuff, defence needs to store or gift stuff. And this is very current. I'm not suggesting that if all six Collins submarines aren't put through a life of type extension, we should give two of them to the Ukrainians, because I think the Ukrainians are doing just fine without submarines. I think we should stick them in storage somewhere, tie them up somewhere, and if a world war comes along, we'll be very glad we have them. But we're going to be disposing of some M1 tanks and some Tiger attack helicopters, I believe.
Both things that the Ukrainians would be very interested in, and since they are already operating M1 tanks, you would have thought that would be a no-brainer to actually gift or sell at mates rates to the Ukrainians. But the Australian government seems to have been a little cagey about saying what it would do. And, you know, when I look at all of this, it seems to me that the main thing that the government and defence are worried about is the, quote, bad optics of seeing Russians getting killed by former Australian military equipment. I'm not sure I'd be particularly worried about that, but
I'm not sure there's a groundswell of outraged Australians ready to protest up at Parliament if an ex-Australian tank kills Russian soldiers who are trying to capture Kharkiv in Ukraine. I think there'd be rousing cheers. And if they're worried about the Russians will capture a former Australian M1 tank and stick it on a plinth in the victory parade in Moscow.
They've done that already with Bushmasters.
And I think that just says, gosh, they think these systems Australia has given them, the Bushmasters, are important enough to celebrate if they destroy or capture one. So if the Ukrainians haven't asked, I would encourage them to ask for the M1 tanks and the Tiger attack helicopters. And maybe they should do something they didn't do when they asked for the utility helicopters, which is make their request in a full-page ad in several Australian newspapers. Because I remember their formal request for the MRH-90 utility helicopters was denied by the Australian government for some time. No, they haven't asked. Oh, they asked us, but they asked us late. So
and
we
once,
should take
once
that
was
out of their
once
hands.
It was determined that they had asked, the Australian Army then said, well, we actually looked at this and we think it's not the right capability for them. So we actually know better than the Ukrainians what is the right capability for them. So we're not going to give it to them.
Yeah, that answer would be very hard to give on the M1 tanks, though, wouldn't it?
Because that would be very hard to give on the M1 tanks. Them. Unless you took the argument that tanks are irrelevant in modern conflict, which our Army seems to be saying is not the case, that armoured vehicles are still very relevant.
Well, I've got real doubts about the utility of crewed attack helicopters, but my view is simple. If we ask the Ukrainians if they want those Tiger helicopters and they say yes, then they should be crated up and sent to them. That's the end of it. I wouldn't be trying to double think or outguess the Ukrainians, and I might have a view about them, but if they tell me they want the Tigers, they should have them.
The other role for retired Australian equipment is actually again, mothballing, because we may need it. So we are pretty soon, I think, going to have former Royal Australian Navy ships piling up on the dock. So we've retired the first Anzac frigate. We retired a Minehunter Coastal as well. We're down to 3 Minehunter Coastals. We're down to 7 Anzac frigates. Another one is due to retire in a couple of years' time, and I suspect they will follow in rapid succession. However, we have no guarantees of when their replacements are going to arrive. At the moment, the first Hunter is meant to be delivered around 2032, be operational around 2034. That's 10 years away. Ooh. Meanwhile, we have this last desperate roll of the dice called the General Purpose Frigate Program, and I think you and I both agree there are no guarantees that that is going to deliver on the government's schedule of by first one by 2029. So I would be keeping all of these things because we may need them.
Well, the lesson is obvious, isn't it, out of the war in Ukraine? If you're in a war, you can't build stuff fast enough to keep your military in the fight. So if you've got old stuff and you can restore it to operational condition in a crisis, that's great. If you sunk your old stuff as dive wrecks, that's bad news.
Pretty hard to get a dive wreck back in the fight.
So we'll see if Defence is paying any attention to the words in the National Defence Strategy about our rapidly deteriorating security environment, by whether they persist with disposal strategies for the Anzac ships, the Minehunters, the M1 tanks, and the Tiger attack helicopters.
Yep.
Now, thinking of retiring and old stuff, there's also something that's relevant to the veteran community, veteran military personnel and
veteran public servants, veteran, like us.
Old public servants, whether in WA or South Australia. So, and that's the Safeguarding Australia's Military Secrets Law that
the
is now
SAMS
in effect.
Act, yes. And very controversial.
Who could be against safeguarding Australia's military secrets?
Well, we want to protect those secrets. So is this the right way to do it, Michael?
Well, we've got to remember, why did this law get put in place? It got put in place because just a few years ago, there were newspaper reports that said Australian fast jet pilots out of our Air Force after they'd retired might be training Chinese military jet pilots. And the general reaction to that was a bad thing, that retired Air Force fighter pilots shouldn't be training the Chinese military to fly fighter jets. And the result is this extremely broad, far-reaching legislation that captures everybody who is in the military or the public service in defence. And if they want to work for any organisation that's a foreign government or attached to a foreign government that isn't a Five Eyes country, so UK, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, they need to apply for a permit from the Defence Department.
Yep.
And if they don't get a permit and they work for a foreign country, they can be put in jail for up to 20 years.
Mm. So, yes, it would cover us.
Yes.
It would cover us. So I'm taking a personal interest in this because I don't really want to go to jail for 20 years.
Let's say a Korean company like Hanwha approached you and said, hey, you know, we've got some work we're doing with the South Korean government. Presumably you'd be captured by this permit. You need to apply for a permit.
And this is the problem. I'll bottom line up front. I think this is about the worst legislation I've ever seen because I cannot understand how it is meant to work. I have been following it. I've read the explanatory memorandum. I've gone to the defense website that explains it. I've actually attended an online information session with senior defense leaders who are meant to be explaining how this is going to work. I still don't understand how this is going to work. So let's take Thales. Ooh. So a French company with a very large presence in Australia, a lot of Australian employees doing really good work. Is this one of those foreign controlled entities?
Yes, I think it is.
So does that mean that everybody who works Australian, former military or defence APS person who works for Thales now has to apply for a permit to work for Thales?
I think so. Unless they want to go to jail. If defence at some time, future time, looks back on what they were doing and says, well, actually, I didn't want you doing that. I didn't know that Thales were going to be selling that to the Poles. I've had a falling out with the Poles since then. You, my friend, didn't get a permit, so you're going to jail. Straight to jail. Do not pass go.
Yeah, well, so let's take Rheinmetall. So Rheinmetall Australia is making 100 Boxer armoured vehicles for the German military. So does that mean anybody working for Rheinmetall Australia who's involved in making Boxers now has to apply for a permit?
Well, I don't know, but I would say, you know, I read some of the stuff on the defence website about this and the explanatory memorandum, and I'm none the wiser either. And I used to work in the area of defence that issued export controls, so I have kind of delved into some of this detail, but it's very hard to tell what this new law does. However, I did notice in the announcements that defence said this legislation works, is closely aligned with the defence trade controls and export control laws. And I thought, well, I'm not sure it is, because in this permit system, the only exempted countries are the Five Eyes, but in the defence trade controls, you've got NATO and Japan that are exempted along with Five Eyes. So there's an obvious lack of alignment. But the other conflict to me is with the Defence Industrial Development Strategy, because there we learned, to my surprise, and I'd say to just about every Australian who has a thinking mind about them, that a sovereign industry was any company that had an ABN, an Australian business number, and a supplied products or services that could be used by defence here in Australia. So Huawei Australia and Hikvision Australia have ABNs. They supply products and services. They're sovereign defence industry. If you're working for sovereign defence industry, surely, by definition, you'd be safeguarding Australia's military secrets. You must be able to share military secrets with sovereign industry. So any company that has an ABN and meets that Defence Industrial Development Strategy definition of sovereign defence industry surely has to be exempt.
I know you're being very flippant, Michael, but yes, I would agree with that principle.
I'm just saying there's an incoherent chain of thinking in the defence organisation with these different pieces of work.
Well, so we take Thales. I mean, okay, Thales is now sovereign Australian defence industry, and yet it sounds like if you're working, an Australian working for Thales, you have to get a permit to work for Thales.
Because otherwise Australia's military secrets will not be safeguarded from this sovereign entity.
You know, but the other misalignment with the export control regime is a company can get a permit to export an article to another country. That doesn't cover the individual employees of
who
that company
that
who now need to get a SAMS permit. So it is just riddled with inconsistencies.
Well,
but what I find most reprehensible about this, Michael, is we have had senior defence leaders fronting up to the Royal Commission into veteran suicide, saying we value our people, we're going to look after our veterans better. The first thing that comes out of defence after that is this piece of legislation which basically says we regard all former defence personnel as a security threat, and we're going to have to monitor them, and they're going to have to apply for permits if they want to work in defence industry.
Well, I
find it reprehensible.
I agree. I think if you really want to encourage post-separation employment of veterans, you need to make it easier, not harder, and you shouldn't be hanging 20 years jail over them if they didn't fill in a form and get a permit. But I think getting right back to why do we have this law? So we have this law because allegedly, this hasn't actually been proven, but it looks like it happened, some former Australian Air Force pilots thought it was okay to train Chinese military pilots. Well, it isn't, and it's actually probably illegal under current law that they're obligated to. So they received highly classified information as part of their Air Force jet training Chinese military pilot. They have those classified information obligations that exist throughout their whole lives before this SAMS law came along. But the thing about this is, to prosecute a former Air Force pilot for training a Chinese military pilot, you've got to gather evidence, you've got to do some homework, you've got to prosecute them. And that could be hard. So I can hear defence officials saying to Richard Miles, Minister, we're not sure we could prosecute these people.
So we'll get them for not having a permit.
So instead of doing the right thing and having to assemble a brief of evidence that proves an offence, what they've done is the lazy thing. They've said, you know, I don't want to have to prove a damn thing. What I want to do is say,
I'll get them for not having
a permit.
Yep.
And all the obligation is on you, the ex-service person or the ex-public servant. I can sit here and rustle fat, dumb, happy and blind. And when a problem happens, all I have to do is say, did you get a permit? And if you say no, you're going to jail. So it is lazy and incredibly broad. It works completely against the grain of a free society. And the only way it makes any sense is if you're an incredibly lazy bureaucrat who can't get off their bottom to assemble a brief of evidence.
But it is yet another example of defence working to undermine government priorities. So government priorities seem to be, when you look at the DIDS, the Defence Industry Development Strategy, about helping industry, making, reducing process, allowing industry to deliver faster. And again, what's the first thing we do after releasing the DIDS? Here's more red tape. Here's more process. Here's some stuff to make it harder for you to recruit people, harder to retain people. So we're just going to undermine everything we're trying to do in accelerating the acquisition process.
Well, and if you want to see how badly designed and how self-obsessed this SAMS law is, you could look at Schedule 1, Part 1, because part of
all
this is...
All former defence band members out there...
Warning.
Get apply for a permit.
So there's so much intricate stuff in this. So you've got to know which job family you might have been in defence, in the military or the public service, to then know how long you might need to apply for a permit for. Because if you've done a particular job family job, you might only need to get a permit for a year or more. I'm not sure how the or more bit
is. The years are how long you've been out of defence for. So in some job families, if you've been out of defence for less than a year, you got to apply for a permit. In some other very closely related job families, it's 5 years.
Yeah.
So and for others, it's 10 years. So you've got to pick exactly which job family you are in, because fine differences
if you get it
can
wrong,
make a 20-year
so
years in jail difference.
Customer service in, and you think that your job family is administration and customer service, but it was a printing and publishing function in the administration and corporate support job family, customer service job family, then it's only 1 year or more after you leave.
I do, however, find it quite remarkable that even if you're a printer, you worked on the defence switchboard, you're in the defence band, you still have to apply for a permit. The period may only be a year that you're covered by this for, but we are making people like that apply for a permit. Are you serious?
But, and if you've done stakeholder management in the corporate support job family, it's 5 years or more after you leave. Defense. So just the internal intricacy of the definitions, which again are
just means they're going to find a way to get you. Yeah, this is all about finding a way to get you.
You will have committed a crime, because you may have thought you're in one job family where you didn't need to apply for a permit after a certain period of time, but you find out that you're actually in another job family.
Yeah, but and my understanding is when you apply for a permit, it is not for you for every piece of work you do. You need to apply for each piece of work. So again, you're going, I work for TELUS and I've done some work over here for this customer overseas, and I've done some work over here for this customer, and I'm just doing some general research in the middle, and I don't know how that's going to be used. I need to apply for a permit for all of those activities. So
if you're doing work,
I don't know which bureaucracy Defence is setting up to manage all of these applications for permits.
Well, the thing we haven't talked about underneath this is what's the underwater part of the duck for issuing these permits? So who's making what decision on what grounds?
Yeah.
Either they're just going through a ticker box thing and saying, well, that's Japan, that's okay, that's NATO, that's okay. I don't know why we didn't put them in the original list. That's one way, but then it's a pretty empty permit system. Or they're doing some really deep dive about, oh, Marcus Hellyer, let me dig out his career, let me look at the information he had in his possession, let me see his security track record, let me look at his psychological assessments.
Don't look at my psychological assessments, don't go there.
That to do this well, you've got to bring a whole lot of extra information to it that I'm confident, even though Defence has enough information on me to clone me, they don't know where it is. And so I doubt they can do a deep dive. So I just think the whole process for this legislation
I don't know how it's meant to work. So,
as its original conception.
So, is a bureaucrat in defence meant to, like, look at all of my historical information, look at, oh, they want to work for TELUS on sonar, and somehow put those two together and go, no, too high a risk? Really?
Well, the other thing it tells me is all those obligations that I have about protecting classified information must be meaningless.
Mm.
Because as soon as someone breaks them and trains a Chinese jet pilot, a fighter pilot, they can't be prosecuted. So whatever security obligations people thought they had apparently was so broken that they needed this incredibly overreaching, badly designed legal instrument.
I'll just repeat what I said. To me, this is the worst legislation I've ever seen. I have no idea how it's meant to work. And I will say that after sitting through a briefing with senior defence leaders, they have no idea either.
Well, you get that refuge of the scoundrel problem where they say, but if no one's doing anything wrong, they have got nothing to worry about. A body searches for everybody. So the worst thing is this vision of defense bureaucrats making decisions about what people can and can't do on wholly spurious concerns and very poor information. And I think that is the law we now have on the books.
Well, that's the other thing, Michael, is this law has now passed. And so there is a very narrow window now for people to apply for their SAMS permits. Because this is reality now. And yet Defence doesn't even know how it's meant to work.
If Defence was spending more time increasing Australia's military power quickly, I'd be happy. Instead, the way they're spending their time is likely to disable
Australian
industry's ability to cooperate with key partners internationally. And I just do not know why that stacked up
yet,
as a priority.
Yet another example of defence creating more process and bureaucracy to actually undermine good outcomes in the defence sector.
But frankly, the Parliament has let us all down here too, because this thing should not have withstood first contact with parliamentary scrutiny.
Well, again, it's that thing. Nobody wants to be seen as soft on defence and soft on security. So nobody in the Parliament's asking hard questions about, is this actually a good piece of legislation?
Well, and I noticed they weren't offering themselves up and their advisors to be caught by this, were they?
So yes, good catch there, Michael.
The scope of this is APS, so public servants employed in defence and military personnel in defence, consultancies.
No consultants, contractors who did the exact same job as that public servant, sitting in desk right next to him doing the same job, they're not covered.
They're doing line jobs.
Intelligence agency personnel. Intelligence agency personnel not covered, nor are ministers or their staffers who may have seen the most exquisitely classified cabinet submissions.
And a lot of former ministers and advisors have a strong track record of working for various foreign entities.
Surely not, Michael.
Again, just a basic design flaw in safeguarding our military secrets is it doesn't capture a whole bunch of people who appear to have proclivities to work for foreign governments and organizations who have those military secrets. So this thing just does not pass the go test. All right, well, we are out of time. I've got to get to a banquet with various maritime trade employees here in Henderson. We've got our log of claims ready to go based on you succeeding in Osborne.
Yep.
So you get back to it and get, what are you after, 25%, 40% increase?
Well, we're starting at 60 and they might bargain us down to 40, I think.
All right, well, what price security, Marcus? Yep. Good luck.